Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Single Tracks podcast. My name is Jeff, and today my guest is Dr. Kate Leeming. Kate is an explorer and adventurer who has biked tens of thousands of miles around the world, including 15,000 miles around the Australian continent in 2004 and 2005, and also 22,000 kilometers across Africa from Senegal to Somalia. In 2019, she became the first person to cycle 1,600 kilometers through the sands of the Namibian coast and is working toward the first ever Antarctic bicycle crossing via the South Pole for her educational outreach organization, Breaking the Cycle. Thanks for joining us, Kate.
It's a pleasure, Jeff. Good to be there on the other side of the world.
Yes, speaking to you from around the world. Well, I wanted to start by asking you about your first memory of going on an adventure. You've got this long list of accomplishments and adventures that you've undertaken. So how did it all get started?
Yeah, well, I actually grew up in Western Australia on a farm that's fairly remote. Well, it's about 80 miles east of Perth. I didn't really have the confidence to travel or anything like that, and didn't really have the opportunity till after I left university. You know, I was a pretty high-level sports person and a bit of an all-rounder, and I just loved cycling as a way of keeping fit, you know. And then I sort of imagined, wouldn't it be amazing to cycle in France or Italy? And I read a magazine article and thought that'd be great. Mm-hmm. Then I did have the opportunity to go to Europe, to the UK first, playing field hockey. After that, I organised some little trips, and that sort of led to bigger trips. And over the space of the next couple of years, I did about 15,000 k's, so about 9,000 miles through Europe, and that was really just, you know, my personal discovery. And that's where I started to discover what I could do on a bike, and I really sort of discovered my passion. And so it started with a little trip in Ireland with a friend, and then a bigger trip in France. So I guess the reasons I really love to travel by bike is because I'm very connected with the people in the land, and I love sort of that idea of bringing a line on a map to life. Mm-hmm. And I find it gives a great sense of place and a perspective of how the world fits together. So,
yeah.
And of course, you can eat a lot, and it's just, you know, it's just, I felt very free, and yet it's a very humbled sort of form of transport, and especially in Europe, where it's just so accepted. You know, cycling through France and Spain and Italy in particular, you know, people go out of their way to help you, or they're very kind. And that's kind of where it all started, and that's where the passion grew. But then it started to grow after that.
Well, when you were growing up on the farm, you know, was it like a big farm where you could like really go and sort of get lost, you know, away from the house? Or were you at an early age like trying to venture beyond that and saying like, well, what's outside the fence? I'm going to go on my bike and I'm going to take off for a few hours and just see what's out there.
Well, it was adventurous in that our farm was, it's not a particularly big farm in that part of the world. It's about 2,000 acres. But our nearest neighbor was, you know, 5 kilometers away. So, I'm one of five, but we're all sort of quite spread out. So that meant spending a lot of time on my own, but also making things and I probably spent more time with my next sister up or my younger brother. But it was always, we're always doing things. It's so, looking back on it, we're just, you know, so lucky to do that. But Western Australia is probably, you know, very isolated, you know, from the rest of the world. So to get to anywhere, even the eastern states, as we'd call it, you know, it was actually quite expensive. You know, I remember going across to play field hockey, like a tournament in, say, Tasmania or whatever, and it's like it used to cost about $800, and that was with student discount. You know, so it's not like the US in that respect. So that sort of means that you don't tend to travel. We didn't certainly travel, and it was much more difficult then than now to do so. But in terms of just exploring and doing things and just around the farm or within Western Australia, especially the southwest corner, yes, we certainly did things like that. But it was really probably once I got away from my, not didn't need to get away from my family, but once I was actually out there, you know, on the other side of the world, trying things out for myself and where I knew that they couldn't worry about me. And I guess, you know, when I first started saying, you know, I was cycling and I was in the middle of France and my friends had gone off doing something else, so I was cycling through France on my own, they're all really worried. But I wasn't, because by then I realized this was cool. But I always, you know, family, especially parents, always worry. So, you know, I always try and respect that and make sure that, you know, I mitigate the risks. And once they sort of get used to it and they understand what I'm doing and why I'm doing it, that really helps. I don't actually tell them what I'm doing until I'm really about something. So,
yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. And I imagine too, growing up on a farm, you learn to be pretty self-sufficient and, you know, just kind of like making things work with what you have, which I'm sure comes in handy on an expedition where you are truly, you know, somewhere remote at times or isolated, or, you know, you just have what you brought with you in a lot of cases. And seems like you had a good sort of background in that and being able to do that and have confidence to do that.
Yeah, I think it's you just have to work things out and on a doing, you know, as a kid, that you're right, it was a great grounding. Not that I knew what I was going to be doing, but yes, it's certainly that idea of being alone or managing things or just taking the initiative when needed and being aware around. So, you know, on the farm, obviously there are dangerous things around you everywhere.
Right. Yeah. Using,
you know, your father's tools or this or that, but it's also just a, you know, being aware of how to stay safe and those dangers would be, that'd be pretty true. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, the other connection I wanted to make is with your sort of educational outreach organization and the Breaking the Cycle, this side of the adventure. So I'm curious to know, were you a good student in school and did you enjoy learning? It seems like, you know, you're always up for trying something new and experiencing new places. So I imagine you were a good student, but was that the case?
Yes, I was definitely did well at school. I was a conformist. I didn't really buck the system, but I used the system pretty well because I was probably, you know, the best all-round sport in my school, my town. And then when I went to Perth, you know, I represented my state in four different sports. So,
oh, wow.
So it's kind of like, I guess that's also had a big effect on what I do and how I do things, because that's still in me. Like, I'm still a professional sports person now. Mm-hmm. So my approach in terms of my expeditions kind of also is affected by that, and how I plan for stuff and, you know, knowing how to knuckle down when you have to do that and how to be committed and playing in a team when needed, and, you know, all of those things. And I think that sporting background in both individual and team sports is really very, very valuable. And in fact, they help each other, because when I was sort of, just to divert a little bit with the school bit, but I'm now a real tennis professional, a court tennis professional, which is like the original game of tennis. Mm. And when I started combining the expeditions plus the tennis, I found that actually it helped my tennis, because I got to really tough moments in a match. You know, I found I was much more present and much more, I was a better competitor. So I think I had a better perspective. So they kind of help each other. But back to, you know, I went through school, I went through university, and then I went straight back to school again because I became a teacher. And I guess what really struck me when I went back to school, i.e. working as a teacher, as a physical and health education teacher, is that the kids were teaching me more than I knew myself. You know, I was in a school with about 57 different different nationalities. And I realized I'd also led a very sheltered life, you know, on the farm and so on and so forth. So I just needed to get out there and explore the world. So that really, so when I had the opportunity to go to the UK first and then travel through Europe, I really just needed to see the world and understand better how it fits together. So that's probably all those things affected probably the things that I do now, and certainly with the education. So I've never really used my teaching degree that much, but I've always wanted to support, you know, education is so important. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really know how to combine that with the adventures, but certainly in Europe. And then I met a fellow who really inspired me, a fellow called Robert Swan, who's a polar explorer. He's the first person to have walked to both the North and South Poles.
Oh, wow.
He sort of, when I was planning my first big expedition across Russia, he really took me under his wing and really inspired me. And he also taught me that there's much more value to what I was doing than simply riding a bike. And so ever since then, I've always tried to contribute in some way. And the first expedition, the Russian one, was about aiding the children affected by the Chernobyl disaster. Mm-hmm. But after that, everything's been to do with pretty much with education for sustainable development. And it was actually my journey. So I did a 25,000 kilometer journey through Australia, which was a official activity for the UN Decade of Education for Sustainable Development. So it's the first time I had a little education program. It wasn't very good, but I made it, and I realized how hard it is to do that. And you know, I needed help creating those things. And then with the African expedition, breaking the cycle in Africa, this time I had the support of the Victorian Education Department here, so the state of Victoria in Australia. So they mm-hmm. had a program, and then things started to become more effective. And then so each thing that I've done, I've kind of developed things. And with Antarctica, that's mm-hmm. when I started to actually put together Break. I kept Breaking the Cycle as a brand name because I thought it was really mm-hmm. good. And that's what I've added, added in or started to create Breaking the Cycle Education. So it's kind of, you know, that Robert Swan's right, there's so much more value to what I'm doing and all that effort that goes in. I'm trying to realize that value, and I think one of the best ways that I can do that is to be able to share my experiences and learning mm-hmm. and work towards, you know, leadership and contributing towards making better global citizens.
It's a really cool concept to sort of, I mean, there are so many things that I feel like people can take away from these expeditions, you know, I mean, just the sheer like inspiration. Obviously I'm a big fan of like reading stories about these types of expeditions and adventures that people go on. And that alone is inspiring, just to see like what people are capable of. But then to tie in the educational element, like I was even thinking about like my own kids and how much they could learn in terms of like problem solving and planning and, you know, learning about other cultures. I mean, it's like endless, the educational opportunities that it seems like are available there. How do you come up with one of these expeditions? Is it first about, you know, here's a thing that I want to do, a place I want to visit, or is it here is, you know, a mission that I want to help, you know, whether it's poverty somewhere or education, or is it, you know, how can we reach the most people and educate people? Like where does, what's kind of the seed for it? And then how do you build off of that?
It's a very good question, because I think each expedition is quite complex. I think like with each expedition, I grow and learn, and it changes, you know, it becomes a little part of me. It changes me a little bit. So, mm-hmm. so even though I have certain journeys and things I want to do in my mind, I wait till I've finished an expedition. I often get ideas on that expedition. So that's one thing. But each, like, I couldn't have organized or done the Russian expedition without the first experience in Europe, and then, you know, Australia, you know, and then Africa. You know, didn't have the confidence to travel through Africa at all. I really wanted to, but everyone said, you know, this is a dangerous place and this and that. And I knew other people cycled there, so it must be possible. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this is probably a good way to explain how I put together that expedition. So I was looking, you know, then I look at the story, and what story do I want to tell? And that's probably the most important thing and it's got to be something that I really want to see and do and believe and experience. And so the way I got my African idea was that I was looking at a map of education levels across Africa in particular. And I could see basically a band of countries in most need of improved education running basically across the base of the Sahara through the Sahel region. So basically from the most westly tip towards the most easterly tip. And I thought, oh, now that seems like a really interesting theme to start with. And then I started researching. I put a massive amount of research and realized that actually that was all, but you couldn't just look at education without looking at all of the causes and effects of extreme poverty, because that's
right.
They're all interrelated. So that ended up becoming the purpose of the journey, to explore the causes and effects of extreme poverty, but the specifically what's being done to give a leg up rather than a handout, because I was, you know, what I'm doing, I don't want to just be all gloom and doom. I'm creating an inspirational story. I'm going to be meeting all sorts of people. I'm going to be finding out about different, you know, things that are hard to learn about, but I want to be able to present that in a context. So you know, I wanted to, you know, to give hope and create a story of hope and inspiration rather than a negative story. This is bad and this is bad, because there are some difficult things. But you know, Africa, as I very much learnt, is, you know, it's the most diverse continent on earth, and there's so much there, and there's so many bright, smart people that often just don't have the opportunity. So that's kind of how that journey happened. And then because that was my purpose, I then looked at how am I going to tell this story, because just cycling through these issues are so complex. So then I teamed up. I actually had 10 different partners and 15 different projects that I visited during that journey.
Wow.
And so if you look at the route, the shape is sort of going across the base of through this base of the Sahara and through the Sahel and into the Sahara, and then I drop right down towards northern Namibia, through the west side, through you know, Gabon and Republic of Congo and Angola, and down to Namibia, you know, and then back up, because it was for some reasons it was to do with a little bit of safety, trying to go through, you know, eastern Chad and Darfur and things like that would have been difficult. So part of it is about safety, but then it was also about telling the story. And I just had it. And then how do you keep safe? You know, and I just had this massive network of different organizations. I had lots of, especially Australian resource companies with interests in Africa, because they always had connections to the governments. They had their bases in difficult places and cities. I mean, that's how I got through Somalia. I didn't just turn up at the border and say, let me in, because that wouldn't have happened. I actually made all these very specific connections and connections with the governments that protected me. And so it worked a treat. You know, I got right across to the very tip of Somalia through war zones, through the lot, in a continuous line without breaking the line. And meeting all these incredible people, and got there 4 days ahead of schedule after 10 months. So it's possible, you know. But you can see how that expedition, how the idea came together, and then you've got to, you know, pull it all, you know, what is the story that you want to tell? And I think that's, if you know, creating an expedition, that's kind of how I work it. And, you know, there's always a budget and all that kind of thing, so I've got to make it run to a certain time and try to work those things out. So it's all got to come together, really. And then with that, you know, I was connecting with kids back in Australia that time. And now I'm working with on the education front with, there's an American organization called Beluga, I'm sort of, we're creating resources right now. It's very difficult to get that. It's all right to go into classrooms and things. Yes, I can do that. But to get to lots of students all over the world is very difficult, because I think the US, like Australia, is like, you know, each thing, each education department is run by each state. And so just being, you know, something happening in one state doesn't mean you're going to get it right around the US or Australia or Canada. Or the UK. So it's, you know, it'd be fantastic if there was a better system to do that. So I also work with the Duke of Edinburgh's International Award. It's known as the International Award in the US. And that's just, it's all about leadership and being able to, it uses adventure as one of the things, and learning new skills and serving in the community. So it's an incredible award that is quite hard to get. So I work a lot with them. Sometimes I've done a few things for Scouts as well. So I've had some connections with Scouting. So it's all about leadership and getting kids out there. And
Well, are you able to connect directly with many of the students? Like, what kind of feedback do you hear from them? Or like, what are some of the, I don't know, questions or the parts of the story that they're most interested in typically?
Well, you know, if they're responding and following my blogs, you get some, depends on their age, really. You know, with Africa, it's like, have you seen any lions or stuff?
Yeah, then, it's a good one.
They're reading the blogs. It's also about, so they're always worried about the animals. But then if I was telling a story about, you know, a certain issue or whatever, then they often have a lot of concern. So it's just making them aware and getting them to ask questions. And we've actually created, not that it hasn't been taken up by many people yet, but I've created sort of a how to set up a project. It doesn't have to be an expedition, but it could be whatever. Starting with, you know, identifying passions and what are passions, and then what are values, and then creating a vision. What's your vision? And this is what I do every single time, so I might as well, I should, you know. And then from that vision, you know, what's your idea, and how are you going to put it together, and use a bit of what's called design thinking to actually create a project or a journey, and then do a little test run, do the theory, how does it need to improve, and then create your bigger vision, and then analyzing it all after it's done. So that kind of thing is really valuable, because quite often people don't have the get the first step. They don't know how to make that first step. They think, that's what I do, and they say, oh, I can't do that. And that's so annoying. Like, are you sure? I started off by trying little things, and then that gave a bit more confidence. You know, and then that grew and grew and grew. So that's on the expedition side, but then on the other side of it, it's about also getting better at communications, about documenting and analyzing, and you know, I've written a couple of books, but it's, you know, things like being in doing the media, that scared me, you know, just, you know, radio for the first time really, you know, it scared me, being on live TV, it's scary stuff, so it's just like, okay, if I want to be able to communicate, I've got to get better at this. So you know, and same with other skills, photography or whatever, or filmmaking, of course. So I don't have any technical skills for holding a camera, but I'm pretty good at telling a story. So that, if combined with some other professionals when it comes to filmmaking, seems to work pretty well. So there's a lot of other things. You know, the cycling's the easy bit.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's hard to believe. And that part probably scares people the most. So one of your most recent projects, one that is currently hitting the internet this summer, I believe, was in 2019, you completed a traverse of the Skeleton Coast in Namibia. And there was actually a documentary that was made about the trip called Diamonds in the Sand, which I believe is going to be on Outside TV here in the US anyway. Tell us a little bit about the trip. What got you interested in that particular route?
Well, I'd kind of heard about the Skeleton Coast probably in the mid-90s, and there was a British explorer who walked from south to north. And then since then, no one had done anything because you can't actually get permission to cover most of it or lots of it, and particularly there's a forbidden diamond mining area in the south, which you just don't get permits to do, whereas he did it just as Namibia was becoming a country and probably get through because of that. And so I kind of, it just seemed like a really interesting place because of all the shipwrecks and things, and it was desolate and there's this desert. And and then on top of that, because I'm planning, as you mentioned earlier, planning to cycle across Antarctica. And yes, I've been doing expeditions in the extreme cold in the Arctic to prepare, but also cycling on sand is very similar to cycling in snow. And I'd undertaken to do an expedition on every other continent other than Antarctica. So I did another sand expedition in Australia that was very interesting. And so I kind of opened up. And so for Africa, I thought, oh, this could work really well. And I could use the same bike that I've been developing for Antarctica. And so I looked into it further and then realized that this is why no one's done it.
It's not called the Skeleton Coast for no reason, right? I mean, it sounds pretty tough.
Yeah, so cycling from basically the northern border, so the mouth of the Cunene River, which is on the border with Angola, to the mouth of the Orange River, which is on the border, Namibia's border with South Africa. So it's say 1,600 Ks or 1,000 miles. 800 kilometers of that is absolutely no roads. So I'm cycling on the beach and working with the tides. Because I'm planning to cycle in Antarctica, and there I'm going to have terrible wind, especially for the first half going towards the South Pole. The wind can be shocking. I thought, okay, let's choose to go into the wind. And so Namibia, this is one of the windiest places on Earth. The dominant wind just comes from the southwest. It's a coastal. Western Australia gets a similar trade wind as well, but this is probably worse. It's like it's unreal and it's relentless. So going from north to south is much, much harder than going the other direction in the sand with no roads. So that's why I chose to go from north to south. And to say the first, there's no habitat, no points of habitation at all for the first week. So about, I can't remember, 350 kilometers or so. And there's a little tiny settlement. And then, you know, having to go through lion territory. I did it supported because there's no way I could have carried what I needed to carry. There's actually 500 kilometers where there's no way I could even get water, let alone food, and I'm going through the desert. So, so that enables me, but traveling supported enables me to have it filmed properly, whereas on my own, I just can't capture it to the level that's needed. So,
how do you even support a trip like that? I mean, if there aren't roads, like how is anybody even carrying water or camera equipment or any of that stuff?
We still drive on it. So I found a small, very specialist tour operator who has the licenses to go into that northern area, which you can't just go there. You need to actually have various limited licenses, and he holds all the concessions. So there's about 24 concessions that can be used each year up there, and he has them all. So if a tour operator wants to use it, then they've got to get it from him. So so that's how I found him, and he loved my idea. And so he organized the support, so he had to have two vehicles because if one got stuck, the other one could pull.
Right.
And these guys are expert drivers. Like you see them going down, you know, 100-meter drop sand dune, like straight sheer face, and they're just gliding with the sand down the
Right. Yeah. Do brakes even help you at one point? It seems like you just keep sliding.
It's incredible. So this fellow, he didn't come with us, but he arranged a couple of these people. And so we had different people joining us, specialists for the different regions. And so that was a part of it. So it becomes a different type of expedition, but still, I'm going walking speed the first few days because I'm just getting belted. And also because it's tidal, yes, I can follow the beach, but the beach isn't particularly, like, there's about 2 hours in a day when it's relatively firm. And then after that, the tide's coming in and I'm pushed up into the soft sand. So it's just...
Sounds miserable. I mean, the sand alone sounds rough, but to have the wind too, that can really get on your nerves when you're riding a bike.
Well, it's all about attitude. And, it's like it was the perfect training for Antarctica because I was, to learn how to deal with that mentally. And, normally on a bike, you have your cycle computer and you're watching that probably and you think I've got to do this amount of distance, and you can usually hit those because it's even if it's a bit slower or something, you can hit them, but I don't know what I'm going to hit with the next pedal stroke, let alone anything else.
It could be demoralizing to look at the GPS and my goodness, it's been an hour and I've gone like 2 kilometers.
Well, certainly 5 kilometers an hour was what I was down to a few times, and I'm going, okay, wow. I need to do 50 Ks a day to get my expedition done. So the first bit was very hard I was just managing to, just creep up a little bit, get over the 50 a few times, and I was a couple of times under. So it was right on my limit. So I was right with that. And also when I do these expeditions, even though it would help to be super fit, it's crazy putting them together. It's probably the hardest thing I do is pulling all the ends together, getting everything, all the people or just every, moving out of my comfort zone in Melbourne here and traveling around the world to get to a place and with everything that you need and all of the communications, the education side. So I'm just exhausted at the start and I just have to pretty much bite the bullet. I mean, I test to make sure my knee's all right. I do some sort of intensive training in the gym. I try to get out for a couple of rides to make sure I'm, it's real. But then, and often I even get a little bit sick before I start because it's so much stress.
I'm sure.
Then the start from you'd think is the most desolate place, and the wind is, especially in the afternoons, but not only. It was just amazing. So I was just trying to, with my mind, just think, okay, let's just break this down into little goals. Don't worry about distances. Just try to get the time done, and I'm going to keep moving forwards, and that's distance I don't have to do again. And it's just trying to find that right space in my mind, and it's such, even though it's desolate, even though it's harsh, even all of those things, it's also exciting. I can't pinch myself. I can't believe I'm doing this. How do you end up cycling down a beach in the middle of Namibia, or not the middle, but on the edge, in this place that's taken shipwrecks? It's the most treacherous coastline pretty much in the world, uncharted territory. Coming across, ships have been rusted down to nothing. A lot of them are no longer there, or frigate like the Dunedin Star, and all this is a tiny little bit of metal left, and that's it. And those stories, ships used to land, but it didn't guarantee that they survived because they didn't know where they were. Right. There was like nothing around hundreds of kilometers, and they didn't have any water or whatever. So actually, just landing on the beach, saved them temporarily, but not always. Not all of them made it. So most of them, they did in some way if they got an SOS signal out. But so mentally, if you focus on all of those things and thinking this is quite amazing, I'm doing something that no one's done before, and I just love that kind of challenge. It's such a privilege. So if you focus on those kind of things, it also helps to get through mentally.
Right. Well, you mentioned that you rode a special bike. It was a unique all-wheel drive fat bike, I believe, for the Namibia expedition. And it sounds like it's also one you're planning to use for the Antarctica expedition. So tell us a little bit about the bike. Is this something that you're building yourself? Is this like a custom bike, or is this something that people can go and pick up if they're doing their own expedition?
The way it all started was I was trying to design or understand what is the best bike that I could use to cycle across Antarctica. And what is the design? I actually went to the US in terms of I picked out a couple, one in particular, sort of innovative frame builder in Maine, actually, Davis Carver, and he is just so into this idea. So we traded, who knows, 100 emails more, and looking at different designs, what would cut it for such a difficult place. And then we came across this design, a fellow called Steve Christini in Philadelphia, who'd made an all-wheel drive mountain bike. And looking at two-wheel drive stuff before, but there was just like external chains and retrofitted cables and things, and they're already inefficient and going to break. But this was like built in through the shaft, and it looked like it might cut it. But he'd only ever made it for a mountain bike. So I tracked Steve down, and I posed the idea of, would he like to put his technology into a fat bike and to cycle across Antarctica? And he hadn't even been making bicycles for quite a while, because his business has gone on to make motocross. And they make all-wheel drive motorbikes for like the US Navy SEALs and things. But his passion is he loves bikes. He just hadn't been able to make it really pay. So he made the first one. And I tested it up in Svalbard, which is Norwegian Islands, about 80 degrees north. That was my first Arctic trip. And it wasn't perfect, but because it couldn't support a wide enough tire, like the technology has to be built around the width of the wheels, and that becomes quite difficult. But then the second one, my second journey was in northeast Greenland. And he built the second one, which could hold a 4.8-inch wide tire. So I'll trial that one in northeast Greenland. And then he's since made two others that I've trialed in Arctic Canada and then in Iceland. But the Greenland bike became my dedicated sand bike, because obviously sand isn't very good for bikes.
Right. Yeah. Imagine it's more, this is a very complex bike. I mean, it's got, like you said, these drive shafts that have gears and various internal and external parts. Did they get along well with the sand? Did you run into any problems with that?
It's actually quite astonishing how well that lasted. And I believe the Skeleton Coast is possibly the most corrosive environment on Earth for machinery like cars and things. So I guess that explains bikes. Because of the salt, fog, sand, moisture, all the way. Like it's a good test. So I've just kept this one bike and just changing the parts when needed and keeping that for the sand. Numbers 3 and 4 are kept for Antarctica. And they're sort of so this bike can tell a real story. And one of them is the Skeleton Coast. So it handled very well. And what's amazing, because people think, it's a gimmick, or it's got to be really hard to push this thing when it's switched on. It's not, and that's what's amazing, because the way he somehow calculates all of the mechanical advantage, and I'm not a technical person to tell you use the right terms, but the drive shaft, it sort of causes a little bit of lift as it turns. And so the bike can be switched on. The all-wheel drive system, it's got a clutch. It can be switched on and off.
Cool.
So I don't use it all the time, only when I'm in a situation where it's needed to stop it wearing out. The very cool thing is you don't have to drive it unless, so if the back wheel slips, the front wheel engages automatically. So it's like having its own differential built into it. And so it's very helpful, like, you know, hitting like soft patches. You can't see sand or snow. And the bike, I can feel it pulling me out. I mean, yes, it takes a little bit of power, as it would anyway, but it means that it's not a magic bullet. It's like, it just helps me get a little bit more grip and helps me to stay on the bike for longer, like going through the high sand dunes. I mean, sometimes no bike's going to go up the soft face of a sand dune, and, you know, it's hard, but it gives me more chance of staying on the bike for longer. That's what I want it for. Others, it's apparently amazing for downhill because cornering, especially, you know, the front wheel can pull you out when the back wheel flips around a corner, that kind of thing. So there are other uses for it. And since Steve's sort of started with designing mine, and that's, he's sort of tooled up enough to make little batches of these bikes. So
they
there's a sort of 4-inch wide one and a 5-inch wide one, basically, plus his mountain bikes. And now he's also got electric bikes that apparently they're going quite well. I can imagine that having quite a good use for if you're into that sort of thing.
Right.
Which is not my thing, but hey, I can see a purpose for it. So that's a good use of his technology. So, the bike, look, I'm really proud of it because I you know, it's not my, I'm not an engineer, but I've, you know, facilitated that design. And now, you know, I've got another fellow adventurer also about to cycle in the empty quarter in Saudi Arabia, and it's like Oman, and he's going to be using one of those. So the bike's got its place. It's not, depends what, you know, if you're just going down roads and things, you don't need it. I'm using it, the same bike, for my current journey across Australia, which I think I mentioned to you earlier, but I managed to actually get a fall off. I've never had a crash before, or not one. I've had a lot of crashes, but nothing stopped me, and I managed to break my collarbone. So I'm recovering at the moment. I've had surgery just over 4 weeks ago, and plates and screws in my collarbone, and I think should be ready in 4 weeks. We're planning to resume, but I'm using the same bike, and so this time there's out of 6,000 k's, there's about 1,000 kilometers of asphalt, tarmac, a bit more. And then there's a lot of sand and gravel, and then there's sand, like going through the Simpson Desert. And there's also, you know, soft corrugations, which are horrible to use, like corrugations on the surface. So I've decided to take my Greenland bike again. Got a whole set of new innards because the Skeleton Coast really did make a mess of my bike. I put faster tires on for the first for the good road that I've just covered, and then I'm just changing the tires now to have the 4.8s because I'm going to be heading into like the Simpson Desert and things. So it's still a pretty good, you know, as far as fat bikes go, it's very fast for what it. You know, but it's not. Yeah. It's still not going to be as efficient on good roads as other bikes because it's just more rough on the road. But I used 4-inch wide tires for the good road, and now I've got the bigger tires going on as we speak for ready to go again. So
yeah.
So yeah, it's a cool. It's a very interesting technology, and as I said, you know, fat bikes have changed quite a lot of where you can go on sand and snow. This is just it's really an extension of that for when you're wanting a little bit extra. And over the distances that I'm traveling, I'm happy to get that little bit extra.
Right. Every little bit counts, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, as you said, you know, this Namibia trip and others before it are sort of preparation for this bigger trip, this trek across Antarctica. So I'm curious, what did you learn on this Namibia trip? Like what surprises did you come across along the way, or what did you figure out that you want to do differently maybe, or what you're going to expect to see in Antarctica?
I guess there's two parts to that question. One is about the riding side of it, and one is about Namibia. the writing side of it, that was meant to be a mental test in particular, very interesting mental test, but it certainly was the first half of that journey down to where there's some habitation around Swakopmund and Walvis Bay. That is flatter the sand, the high dunes, or that as high, and they're further back. So that was more just vast, open, enormous beaches and just little sort of dry rivers that sort of flow underground and flow to the sea. Wildlife, yes, I mean, you get wildlife because there's, they tend to stay along the rivers where there's potentially food for them. Then in the south, after the, it's like the massive sand dunes that people have seen dropping down to the sea. It's so unbelievably spectacular. So the Namib Desert's the world's oldest desert, and basically vies with the Atacama as being driest. And it pretty much doesn't rain, apart from the most of the moisture comes as fog from the sea because of this cold ocean current. It brings the fog, and that's a lot of the plants and animals are adapted to get moisture from the fog. And even like they have desert adapted lions and desert adapted elephants and things, and they're not a different species, but the lions, for example, have learnt to hunt on the beach, so they to catch seals, so you get lions going into water. Now that doesn't happen
it's hard to imagine.
Yeah, cats in water usually don't mix, do they? But anyway, so, you know, there's quite a zone there where luckily I was able to bring in the help of the world's foremost expert on these desert lions and learn from him. But he also was tracking them, so he knows where they are, and he knew where where I had to pass. So he was protecting us and giving us advice as well. So, you know, there was one right near the roadside, a lioness with cubs, which is like, oh God. So you have to watch the film to see how that one went. I'm still here, which is a good thing. So I just learned so much. But down there's beautiful Gemsbok or Oryx, as you might know of them, beautiful, just in the desert. It's wondering how you wonder how they survive. But brown hyenas, like they're quite rare. And we saw some, and then I also saw one in the distance in the south. And then going through that desert, I just love the deserts anyway. But just learning cycling wise, getting into the right zone in my mind, and also the skill set to cycle the high dunes to get through. You know, I still do 50 odd Ks a day through that stuff. So that's, and I fell quite a few times, but that's okay. That's calculated falls.
Right. A good bit softer, I guess, too. You didn't break your collarbone there.
No, you waited until you
got back to Australia.
Yeah. Not onto a hard clay pan, which is like concrete. It's like, this is different. So no people either. So that was just amazing. Also, you know, but navigation's quite tricky, you know, and pretty easy to get lost. Losing the vehicles, the wind erases tracks very quickly. So there's that. There's the shipwrecks, like incredible. And then in the south, the diamonds bit. So there's basically diamonds come down the Orange River, come from the Kimberley region originally, and over millions of years they come down this Orange River, and then they wash out to sea and then back onto the coast. So the diamonds that were found a bit over 100 years ago or so, a little bit more than that, of course, there's the richest diamond fields in the world. So an area about 300 kilometres long along the coast, and a big buffer zone all the way back in, is called Spurgebiet, which is a forbidden diamond mining area. And so to get permission to go through that is unheard of. And my people there weren't having any luck. And I just started looking on the internet, and I found a mining document with the chief operating officer's email address. And so I contacted him, and he loved the idea of what I was doing. So it was like to get as far as Lüderitz on the northern edge of that is a cool thing, but to do the whole coastline, mm-hmm. including that 300 kilometers, is really special. And basically he reversed the decision to allow us with a strict restricted access permit to go through. So yes, it couldn't go exactly off the coast because a lot of it's rocky anyway, but also for about 100 kilometers from the river up, there's just like mining operations. They actually take the land back from the sea to mine the diamonds.
Wow.
So, but to go through that area, it's like untouched for a century. And it's pristine, and they're gradually mm-hmm. opening it up because the company, which is the NAMDEB, which is the Namibian government, and De Beers, they're just going to be mining in the ocean soon. So that area is going to be fantastic. You know, there's ghost towns and things there. And,
wow. And
so it's just very cool. So I feel very privileged. As far as learning mentally about from that journey for Antarctica, it's really just all of that attitude that we've explained about the cycling and the wind. It's also the strength that's required, the core strength, getting through the sand, which is, say, the techniques are the same as snow, mm-hmm. learning to read the sand, which are the soft bits, you know, path in front, trying to avoid the softest bits if possible. Gaining momentum, keeping the gears very low or light so that when I do hit something soft, I can actually power out of it. Mm-hmm. And that's the only way I can keep going all day anyway. So I was just trying to skim over the surface of the sand, which is similar to snow, and then mm-hmm. when hard stuff, to be able to put that power on with the all-wheel drive system and then, do it again and again. So it's pretty nice, but it's just so rewarding and satisfying as well to think, you know, there's no road there. And I avoid vehicle tracks anyway in the sand because it's harder. It's an amazing thing. And to cycle across Antarctica is a different thing. The main issue for me is the cold, actually, because I come from a warmer climate. And it's very hard for me to get experience in the cold without costing an awful lot of money. And I've done, say, 4 polar training expeditions. Once I have the funding, which is the main issue stopping me, I'll fine-tune those techniques a little bit more. It's getting protective clothing and systems right. That's just needs a bit more fine tuning. I've got the general plan and the general idea of which things are better to wear and use. And I've got ideas for little innovations. Maybe it comes from that farming background. But,
right.
just for example, in the extreme cold, at the start of any session, I'd be very, very cold and you've got sort of a big down jackets on and things. Within about 2 minutes, it's such hard work that you become really warm. The idea of controlling the body moisture, perspiration.
Right.
So what do I do? Like if I stop, what do I do with that coat? And because I've got the other stuff on things underneath. So I'm thinking like a little seat pack but I don't want to be trying to do buckles and straps when it's that cold, because by the time I get them mm-hmm. on and off, I'm cold again. So
right.
I'm thinking like, why not have a Velcro sort of big mouth to open it up, stuff it in, back up again. So it's just like mm-hmm. on, stuff it in, done. No, just little things like that. I haven't had that made yet, but I reckon that's the go. That's my solution for that.
Right.
Just keeping, just trialing out different foods and things, because we've got to be able to carry, even on the plane, getting down there, you're limited and being able to, can't go to a shop anywhere. So it's like you've got to be exact and have the right number of calories worked out and be much more specific in that planning. So I'm always trialing different things. Give you an example, something I trialed for the first time in Namibia was MCT coconut oil, some special stuff. And I reckon having that in the morning was really good. It helped the energy go, kept it going for longer. So just things like that, you know, I'm trialing out, sort of using myself as a bit of a, you know, guinea pig at times.
Right.
So the sand stuff, you know, I'll be on the sand again in this expedition, and keeping these expeditions going are great things to do. They're not just training expeditions. They're actually meant to be really interesting expeditions in their own right. And that also includes altitude training as well, or expeditions such as in the Indian Himalaya that I've done. So they're all meant to be worthwhile on their own, as well as keeping me mentally expedition fit, you know, physically and mentally expedition fit, and just keeping that story going, keeping, and in the meantime, we've created a great film, Diamonds in the Sand, and hope to create another one out of this expedition now. So it should be building on my profile and getting better at other things. And then all the while, you know, I'm looking for the major sponsors. It's not a cheap thing, but if it's a company that can afford that money, it's also, when you start looking at the marketing side of it, it's actually, if you work it out compared to, say, creating an advert for telly, it's a no-brainer. You'd think you'd be supporting me because, you know, the cost so much of a better investment of what they can create out of it. But it's still very difficult, especially when it's me trying to ask for it. You know, when I get more people around me, sometimes that's better. But then it essentially still comes down to me driving it and selling it. So, you know, it's all possible. And I'm not aiming for this year because COVID, we still don't know. In Australia, we still can't even leave the country. So it's too many, you know, risks to get that kind of commitment. The chances of us leaving Australia by the end of this year are still slim. So I'm aiming for the following season. So that'll be November 2022. Okay. I've got to do this soon because I'm getting older, you know. It's like, but, you know, even with that, as I get older, who cares if I'm cycling a kilometre or two per hour slower? It doesn't actually matter. My skills are more about understanding what I can do, and that's what I, you know, and then going with that, and that's how anyone should do it anyway. I'm not trying to break speed records. Doesn't matter. Then how to get there, collarbones, forget about this accident, but generally how to get there safely, and deliver on everything, you know. Obviously cycling, but also all the other parts to the story as well.
A lot of other ones that goes in. Well, I was going to ask you, you know, what were the most challenging parts of the trip, but I feel like it's all challenging. I mean, it's like everything you've mentioned is a challenge, you know, whether it's physical or it's logistical or it's funding or mental or, I mean, equipment. It's like everything is a challenge. And I think to me, that's what makes it so interesting and so exciting and inspirational, even to just see a successful expedition and to think about everything that goes into that. It's just incredibly inspiring. And, you know, I also, we kind of touched on this, you know, it sounds like the research and the logistics are a really big part of it. And, you know, you're talking about even down to thinking about, you know, where are you going to put your jacket when you stop on the bike? I mean, thinking at that level of detail, obviously, I mean, it takes a ton of planning and a lot of foresight. And, you know, I can understand too, that like the physical part, you know, that's kind of an afterthought, you know, I mean, it's like, that's a part of it, but you know, you're going to spend way more of your time, it sounds like, just doing the logistical preparation and planning and fundraising and all of that. And so once that's all in place, getting on the bike is kind of your last concern. Is that an accurate way to sort of put it?
it doesn't matter how good a cyclist you are if you don't find the funds in the first place and you don't have the ideas. So you can go in the gym and you can sit on a stationary bike. You can go out and just do, I mean, you can cycle however you like, but to create one of these, it takes, as you say, such a web of commitments. There's a lot of skills in trying to find the sport support and funding, and then, you know, it's all right to do that for one expedition, but then you can't always ask the same people over and over again. You know, I've got a couple of private sponsors that have really made a huge difference, but the hardest thing probably of the whole lot is actually finding funding. And, you know, it's not really just a donation just for me to do something. It's hopefully an investment that I can give, you know, give some at least at the minimum some good marketing materials back. So the idea of, you know, creating, you know, diamonds in the sand, where we're creating good, we're creating a story, we're creating this amazing story actually, that I'm so proud of. But then now hopefully, you know, sponsors will see that, they've seen that it's been out on Outside TV, it's about to be shown on Nat Geo Asia, 54 countries next.
Oh wow.
I know Sky New Zealand's bought it, still sort of trying to sell it in Australia and the UK and stuff. But, you know, it's like that's the first time I've got it to that level, and hopefully that helps my marketability to make the other pits a little bit easier. You know? You know, I also write, so I write magazine articles and things. So all of those extra things feed back into that the idea of, you know, I'm afraid I have to sell myself as a brand here, even though it's not what I think, but we're all brands.
Right. What we do. Right.
So it's just a matter of trying to realize the value of the journey for sponsors, but also especially education wise. And when you see, I guess one of the things that makes me feel most satisfied is when people get it, they actually read a magazine article, or they hear me speak, or they see a film, and they go off and they create their own challenge journey, and it changes who they are, and that's the most, or probably almost the most rewarding thing, and it really inspires me to do it better, to get to more people. So that's happened quite a bit, especially like talking in schools, and kid, you know, the students can, you know, really have some great ideas, and you know, when they just go off and do their own things, that's really amazing to me. It doesn't have to be kids, it can be adults too. You know?
Right. So right.
That's fine. You know?
Well, another one of your accolades that we haven't mentioned is that you're a fellow at the world renowned Explorers Club in New York, which first admitted women, I believe, in the 1980s. So I wanted to ask you, what are the challenges that women continue to face in the world of adventuring and exploring today?
Well, I think that the field has changed quite a lot in, say, the last 10 years compared to when I was first trying to find sponsors and get things up and running, say, pre-Africa especially. I mean, I was lesser known too, but just to get seen and to get the PR compared to a guy, I think, was way harder. And then in people's minds, I think it was also, if a woman can do it, it means a man can do it easily. And that's just not true. It's like yes, sometimes there's a difference in physical strength, but there's so many other ways of doing stuff. And a lot of women are pretty strong too, I must say. And there's the mental side of things. And often, in fact, women tend to plan things that they can, realistic things, and sort of those things in place a little bit better than older men do, but sometimes the younger guys are a bit more gung-ho. but now I think, they'll do some amazing stuff, but then there's a lot of, put themselves probably in dangers that are unnecessary. But I think now there's actually, especially with not just the Me Too movement, but before that, and I think there's a really fantastic opportunities for female adventurers, and even when it comes to having those who are able to lead on with series and things, there's quite a market for it. So it's kind of turned around a lot, to be recognized from my university as well with an honorary doctorate. It's like that was because of, in particular, because of they saw me do a presentation like I did an Australian tour with presenting and showing about, especially about Africa and that work, mm-hmm. and the ability to communicate that work and the community work and education work that I've done. So it was kind of full on honor, and those kind of things help too, just to be recognized. And I don't crave that, but to be recognized actually helps and opens the playing field up a little bit more, mm-hmm. If that makes sense. But so right. I don't do things because I'm a woman or a man. I just do things because I want to do things. And, I guess growing up, it was certainly, in the 70s, 80s, I was very young in the 70s, but there's certainly a certain culture, especially here in Australia. And so it takes a while to step out, like to have the confidence to step out of that and not do what's expected. And yes, I could wrong with being a teacher or that career that I might have had, but I don't think I would have been satisfied because I it wasn't me on its own. I felt I just wasn't. So the kids would teach me more than I knew myself. I didn't feel like I was very complete there, and so I wasn't. Yeah. I was just going through the motions rather than really appreciating that job. So I think that idea of being able to step out away from my family first, so that they, mm-hmm. and then it's taken me a long, long, long time, decades, to get to this point. So, I'm going to explore that now to do whatever I can, and to use all of those experiences to be as to have as greater impact as possible. And I'm always planning and thinking of the bigger things now, and thinking, okay, how do I make that count? And what is the message that I'm trying to say? So it's, I'm doing that through adventure and expeditions and things, and but then I have to push myself as the presenter or, whatever. So mm-hmm. it's all part of it. And so
yeah. And you're obviously, you're representing and showing other girls and women that this is something that they can do too, right? I mean, it's, obviously when you were younger, you didn't have those same role models or other explorers or adventurers who were female to look up to. And so, it seems like, hopefully this is something that can kind of snowball, and obviously you are a very big part of that.
Yeah. Well, I try to do what I can, and sort of, I think just lead by example is probably a way of looking at it, and I'm happy to inspire men too. It's not, and in fact, often, just about always, I have if I've got a support crew, I've done more than half of my journeys I've done without support. I've done about 55. I've worked this out. I've done about 55,000 Ks unsupported, and I've done about 30 or so supported, but they're different things, and it was before I was going, you've got to do this unsupported, blah blah blah. It just depends on the message, and often I find supported expeditions actually much more difficult in that I have to find about four times as much money and kind of support, and I've got to find a team that's I've learnt the hard way with that, especially one of the hardest things about my breaking the cycle in Africa wasn't Africa, it was managing the team. When I'm out there in the mud or in the sand or whatever, and they're, cooped up in a vehicle and getting disgruntled, and I can't control it. And it's, yet it's my vision, it becomes very difficult. It shouldn't be a barrier, but I think women, and they're often more calculating, and they want to keep themselves in a less of a risk-taking environment, but it's really, my advice would be just to try small things, to just test little things out, and then it's amazing what you can do. But most people will tell you, you can't do that, or or you'll get that feeling, or how do you break out of that? But you've just got to take that step out the door. But you know, have right. a plan and then think about the story you want to tell. That'll make a big difference as well. And then you might not, you know, you might learn about what equipment to take, or but a lot of it's also in your mind about how to sit on a, you know, not just sitting on a bike for 8 hours a day. I'm thinking about things and I'm putting things in perspective, and I've got all sorts of techniques that are useful in other parts of my life that I've learnt on a bike. So there's a lot of things you need to put in, but you can't beat experience. So
yeah. Well, obviously not everyone is going to be able to ride their bike around the world or, you know, explore some of these environments that you're able to get to. So are there other ways that people can be sort of curious explorers in their day-to-day lives? Do you have some like sort of concrete advice for people who maybe want to get started, or people who just want like a little taste of adventure, of that life, you know, to kind of, I don't know, switch things up a little bit.
I think everyone should try to include it in some way. The warning is that it can be addictive. but definitely, you know, you imagine, you know, you have a long weekend. Why not plan something? You know, just think about your bike. And it takes a bit of courage to start with, but you can't not try it. And you'll be surprised at what you can actually do. And then once you've tried a little thing, then you think, okay, well, maybe I'll try this little journey. And I like the idea of putting it into a journey, because it just means a bit more, like to get from A to B, or whatever your challenge is. It doesn't have to even be a physical journey. It could be whatever that journey, put it into sort of that perspective. And that's what I also put to kids, you know, it's about first creating the vision. I spent ages creating the vision before I do anything else, because if you're not 100% certain what you're doing and why you're doing it, and, you know, that kind of thing, the times are tough, that's when you're less likely to pull through. You've got to be able to, you know, if you really have that clear in your mind. So I spend a lot of time putting that vision in place and imagining what it can be like, and doing research, and then all of my journeys have had to be adapted a little bit, because that's the nature of adventure. But right. I always try and keep that journey in a continuous line. Try not to break the line of my journey. I can go off the journey and see something, but then I come back to the point. So especially when it's supported, and then I've got to go and see a project or whatever. There's no drama in driving away somewhere to go and meet certain people, but then I come back to that behind that point, so that I keep that.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like the narrative. It's this real journey. It's like I've done every kilometer or whatever. So for anyone, I would take some time, have a go. Don't have to tell everyone about it. You don't even have to do that.
You don't have to post it on social media? Is that what you're saying?
No, not to start with. Not unless you want to. I mean, you can do. But don't feel that pressure that, you need to be compared with other people. It's your journey. And, you know, for me, I'm ultra competitive. So I don't – sometimes I'll try things out quietly first and just make sure they're going to work before I start posting things. That's a very different world to when I started, and you know, it's a very necessary world that I'm probably not the master of and should be better at. But you know, you've got to be able to post things, and sure, you can publish things, but you can still choose what you publish. So you can still go out there and have a little adventure, and it could be your little adventure. You could be your adventure with your dog or whatever it is, but you know, it could be whatever, but just have a go. I tend to do, because my journeys tend to be quite my visions, that these days I tend to cycle. If I'm doing them supported, especially, you know, I'm doing them on my own, which I'm very comfortable with, it's very if you have someone that you're adventuring with, that's great. But just make sure that you're both on the same page with the vision in the first place. Otherwise, things can, you know, it really tests people out. So you might find you think you really know someone, but when you're under real pressure and when you're pushing it out day after day or whatever, you know, you might not know them as well. So that can test relationships. But that's another thing, you know, just do that adventure with a friend. That's something, you know, depends on you really. But give it a go.
Yeah. Well, that's all great.
Yeah.
Well, that's all great advice and definitely inspiring, to think about the things that are possible, you know, at the sort of human limits and the scale of what you're doing. But then for all of us to think about sort of what we're capable of or what excites us, and then just going for it. I mean, it sounds like you, you know, you never know what you can do until you try to do it. And then you're going to learn something along the way, even if you don't do it. You know, you may get out there and figure out you don't like doing it, or you learn a better way, and you always just come back and plan the next one.
Absolutely. You know, it's a part of life. So it doesn't have to be, say, it doesn't have to be on a bike. It doesn't have to be walking. It could be whatever everyone's different. And that's great. That's how it should be. Give it a go, but you've got to step out there at some point. Don't just sit in at home planning it on behind a screen all the time. You've actually got to, you know, and that's how we learn. I mean, that's innate of human beings. That's what makes us different from other animals, is our curiosity. That's where it all starts from. Everything that we've ever achieved as human beings has come from exploration. It's come from being able to explore, to be able to find things out, work things out from science, from, you know, experience. That's how we learn. So we're meant to do it.
Yeah. That's awesome. Well, Kate, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us and inspire us with your journeys. And we're really looking forward to hearing more and seeing what you're able to do in the next few months and years. So thanks.
It's a pleasure, Jeff. It's been lovely talking to you on the other side of the world.
Yes. Well, the documentary Diamonds in the Sand will air on Outside TV this summer. And you can also find out more about Kate's previous expeditions and some of the things that she has coming up at breakingthecycle.education. And we'll have that link in the show notes. That's all we've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week.